I will outline in a more general way links, bridges, connections between the two fields of philosophy and architecture, and also try to make a case for why architecture is a pretty good theme and topic to look at if you are interested in cultural analysis and cultural critique, as we say in Germany. And in doing so, I will particularly emphasize towards the end of my talk someone who has been very important and influential in this field of cultural critique, Theodor Adorno. And since Theodor Adorno talked a lot about modern architecture and used architecture not just as a metaphor or an image for his critique of late capitalism, but also was interested particularly in this connection that you already pointed out and that I hope to be able to explain to you of architecture and hospitality, because Adorno talks a lot about that. I will also try to shed some light on this important link here. Now, next to outlining in a very general sense this connection that I was talking about, I also would like to give you very short summaries of three chapters of a book that I'm preparing right now about architecture and philosophy, or in a more general sense, architecture and thinking. The book is called Architecture and the Construction of Ideas, and so it deals with particular people who could be philosophers but could also be just theoreticians or thinkers or critics of modernity, of modern society, and how they used architecture to come up with a more general critique of the state of things today, if you want. And in the very beginning, I will also try to outline a little bit with a historical, from a historical perspective, why for an Americanist, someone who's interested in American literature, but also American culture, American society, why architecture could be, or is in fact, such an important idea and has always been for Americans. And the reason is that building as an activity, an enterprise, has become so crucial for Americans, and that is in fact what I want to begin with tonight. And of course, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, someone I will mention in passing, you know, once said there's no architecture without a philosophy, and I hope that at the end of the talk you'll see why he would say that. If you know Frank Lloyd Wright, of course, it's kind of obvious, but anyways, I hope to shed light on that as well. So I want to begin by asking a simple question. What is it that connects a popular American podcast titled How I Built This, that you can see here on this slide, to the construction of four makeshift spiral towers in Watts, Los Angeles, assembled over a lifetime from a plethora of discarded items by Italian-American immigrant Sapato Rodia, or to Henry David Thoreau's famous experiment in lowly living, as he calls it, as described in his 1854 memoir Walden, or Life in the Woods. Obviously, the latter two are all about building in the literal sense. That is, they involve the actual erection of an architectural construct, or in Thoreau's case, the designing and building of a temporary home. The podcast, on the other hand, uses the notion of building in a different, more figurative sense. By telling the story of successful entrepreneurs, idealists, and innovators, and the companies and movements they built, it promotes American entrepreneurship and capitalism as a never-ending resource of talent and ingenuity. Like Rhodia and Thoreau, however, the people portrayed in the podcast are doers and builders. How I Built This taps into a powerful cultural imagery, the building of a company, a city, or a nation that resonates with Americans ever since they've framed the Constitution. The framing itself is yet another distinctly architectural metaphor. The imagery of building is so compelling because it evokes the history of the nation itself, its arduous transformation of an allegedly unsettled, barren continent into a blooming landscape of cities, canals, and roads. Building something almost became synonymous with being American. Its profoundly optimistic, civilizing mission seems to have shaped not only American history, but the American mind itself. If most Americans agree that building something is as American as apple pie, there is much less consent as to the social role and function of a building, how we use what we have built, how we dwell in our buildings, architectural or otherwise. To an extent, this is true of most modern societies in which time-worn norms and building traditions have become irrevocably suspended. Under conditions of modernity, the designing of a building and the purposes and possible uses which it has been designed for are often diametrically opposed. On the one hand, architects and planners have a tendency to look to the future, to posit new ways of building and dwelling, to push for an original architectural style that differs from previous eras. You can see here in this slide, for instance, Norm Belgedis' famous Futurama, which he exhibited or was exhibited at the New York World's Fair in 1939. Modern architecture, in particular, has been radically forward-looking, socially invasive, and largely bent on reshaping civilization as we know it. Charles Jenks, aptly the famous architectural critic, aptly called this trend in modern buildings, iconic architecture. Yet the very solidity and resilience of the physical building itself also reflect our divided attitudes towards modernization and change. If a breathtaking architectural design can reinforce our firm belief in the future, buildings that have been there for a long time inevitably also connect us, if only in a vague, nostalgic sense, to the world of our ancestors and predecessors. Hence, the popularity of brownstones and refurbished industrial lofts, which in many Western cities, as is true for Lyon as well, as I've came to know, become the most cherished of real estate and the most highly priced. And hence, the often fierce public response to the leveling of an older, allegedly historic building in order to make room for a new, daring design. Architecture, as we all know, can be experienced as either disruptive and disturbing or as reassuring, insofar as it freezes human experience in an aesthetically designed material space. By symbolically arresting the flux of time, the built environment, regardless of its respective practical purposes, can help us to reclaim a bygone past. Its social meaning is therefore not merely to provide housing or infrastructure. Buildings, as Slavoj Žižek argues, create stabilizing counter spaces within an ever-changing and increasingly conflicted modern public space. As concrete manifestations of the modern divide between nature and culture, between place and space, between progress and tradition, and between the individual and mass society, buildings simultaneously epitomize modernity's utopian appeal, but also its nemesis and downfall. It is for this reason that building and design are frequently embroiled in fierce cultural, social, and political debates. Hence, proponents of modernity, as well as its staunch critics, often turn to architecture in order to forge alternative concepts for the future of society and ultimately the world at large. Henry David Thoreau's blueprint for an unpretentious wooden cabin, which he, Thoreau, famously laid out at the beginning of his memoir, Walden or Life in the Woods, which was published in 1854, is a case in point here. His description of a homespun and sustainable architecture that would eventually wither away and erase the traces of its own making clearly questions the ruthless exploitation and land grabbing of many of his fellow Americans. In so many ways, Thoreau's cabin is the antithesis of America's ever-expanding capitalist system. Constructed cheaply and in tune with the natural environment, his makeshift home at Walden Pond has paved the way for many later attempts at changing society through architecture. Modernist reformers such as Buckminster Fuller and Frank Lloyd Wright, as well as environmentalist architects such as Malcolm Wells, and numberless independent small-scale do-it-yourselfers exploring alternatives to our urban industrialist society have built on Thoreau's comprehensive understanding of architecture. Like Thoreau, they believed that architecture involves more than merely the engineering and construction of buildings, roads, bridges, and other forms of human infrastructure. If his search for alternative building and dwelling practices was part and parcel of a more far-reaching critique of the modern condition, for the writers, thinkers, and reformers who followed in his footsteps, architecture likewise provided a stepping stone to a better world. By proposing an American architecture that is radically democratic, deliberately porous and unstable, and in its consideration of regional differences and climates, sustainable, avant la lettre, Thoreau fundamentally redefined the activity of building. If, for his contemporaries, architecture was a powerful trope that often involved the exploitation and destruction of nature, for Thoreau, to build properly also necessitates a proper form of dwelling and a better, more wholesome life in general. In what follows, I want to discuss the importance of the built environment as an incubator of social criticism and the utopian dream of a non-capitalist, more hospitable world. For the purposes of tonight's talk, I focus on merely two writers, the American transcendentalist Henry David Thoreau and the German philosopher and sociologist Theodor W. Adorno, though many more could be listed who fit the above description. Thoreau and Adorno have both turned to architecture to provide alternative concepts for not only the private realm, but for society in general. They seriously pondered the social consequences of modern ways of building and dwelling, and both favored a pre-modern, yet more humane and hospitable form of design. As I will argue, Thoreau's autobiographical blueprint for his unpretentious wooden cabin and Adorno's famous architectural metaphor of an intrinsically alienated modern lifestyle, kein richtiges Leben im Falschen, which he illustrated by way of the design of a modern American apartment building, there is no right life in the wrong one, speak to the prominent role of building and dwelling in modern critical thinking. Now, I'll try to give you a short historical, a little bit of historical context into how dwelling and building has been understood differently in the US than maybe in most other Western countries. In the unsettling of America, conservationist and writer Wendell Berry points out that Americans had no intention to settle, to be where they often inadvertently ended up being. Significantly, if also somewhat paradoxically, the settling of the New World has been undertaken by men and women in transit. As a people, Berry observes, wherever we have been, we have never really intended to be. End quote. Until recently, Americans have been largely a people on the move. Geographically, many Americans kept moving in search of economic opportunities. They fled racism in the South or the crime-infested, deteriorating inner cities in the North, or were drawn to the amenities of and milder climates of retirement states such as Florida and Arizona. And socially, upward and downward mobility further unsettled American lives by pushing them to move into either more extravagant or more affordable new homes. Though residential mobility seems to have somewhat lessened according to a recent study, by and large, Americans remain mobile and disinclined to settle and to take roots. Similar forces have shaped Americans' attitude towards architecture. In a way, American architecture has always been an architecture of as well as in transit. Not only has the country been layered over with thousands of motorways and other manifestations of so-called transit architecture, however variegated and well-designed, American homes themselves are often transitory and makeshift, as if built for easy removal and replacement. Just think of the infamous trailer park, but also of the moving of entire city blocks to a new destination, as here in a particular neighborhood of San Francisco. Nowhere does this become more apparent than in the numerous ghost towns, decrepit urban districts, or abandoned industrial sites which can be found anywhere in the US. If you think of The Great Gatsby, there's a wonderful episode of such a decrepit, urban district called the Wasteland. Within nearly a few decades of their planning and construction, many of these formerly burgeoning cities have become dysfunctional and irrelevant, have become ghost towns, as a matter of fact. Since the early years of the Republic, the search for an American architecture had frequently been cast in a nationalist rhetoric. One might even say that architecture has been imperative for the nation's ongoing quest of a genuine American identity. Historically, American society has always been riddled by a pervasive rift between forward and backward-looking forces, between those who wanted to preserve the status quo and those who were looking forward to an utopian future that differed substantially from previous eras and experiences. By pitting the modern against the pre- or anti-modern, architecture clearly revealed and amplified these polar forces. And you can see that if you look at the American architectural landscape, there are very much, you know, very many instances of utopian architectural constructs and construction right next to, you know, very pre-modern historic buildings that harken back to a previous era. And many of these historic buildings have actually been built in more modern or recent times. And so they are made to look historic on purpose. As Louis Mumford, one of America's greatest critics of architecture, remarked, "Americans have become aware of an architectural tradition of their own only, quote, after they had established their political independence and had thrown off their colonial ways," unquote. Hence, architectural writings often antedated any changes in actual building design. Whether they addressed the issue of style directly, as in Horatio Greenough's article, "American Architecture," published in 1843, or indirectly, as in Thoreau's account of his life at Walden Pond, it was neither Greenough nor Thoreau to whom contemporary practicing architects and their clients paid any attention. Rather, they would look to publications such as Andrew Jackson Downing's The Architecture of Country Houses from 1850, which emphasized truthfulness in architecture, but gave it a very different twist than Greenough or Thoreau. Downing thought of design in social terms. That is, he believed that all ornament, even if imitated and derived from European styles, is useful insofar as it educated the senses of contemporary affluent Americans. The modest huts of the working classes, on the other hand, could only be truthful if the exterior of the houses also expressed the modesty and bleakness of the lives of its tenants. Thoreau, who has taken issue with Downing's so-called associationalist aesthetic model in his article The Landlord, published in 1843, fervently disagreed. And I come back to this article in a moment. When Walden, or Life in the Woods, was first published in 1854, the title page of the original edition contained an engraving of the modest cabin its author had built for himself on a small patch of land near Walden Pond that belonged to his mentor, Ralph Waldo Emerson. In Walden, as well as in some of his essays and journals, Thoreau made architectural consideration a central issue of his broader, more far-reaching critique of contemporary American life. What is more, his remarks on architecture have ultimately proved to be of greater consequence than those of other contemporaries, including Emerson's. It should not go unnoticed, however, that Thoreau would not have been on board with some of the ideas put forth by later organic architects. This is also true of his most prominent follower, the late Frank Lloyd Wright. Wright's notion that a house must express the interior life and that therefore every single detail, every piece of furniture, every partition of spaces, every ornament needs to comply with the broader architectural scheme, Thoreau would have found distractive from the true function of architecture. Nor would he conceive of its modest abode, as did Wright and Sullivan of their designs as a model for all Americans. He insisted that no one should simply adopt another person's mode of living, but that, quote, each one should be careful to find out and pursue his or her own way, and not his father's or his mother's or his neighbor's instead. Even before he began writing his self-built house at Walden Pond, Thoreau had been involved in debates over alternative forms of living in America. During his short stay in New York in 1843, he had written a review of John Adolphus Etzler's utopian book, The Paradise Within the Reach of All Men Without Labor, by Power of Nature and Machinery, an address to all intelligent men, the cover page of which you can see here in this slide. The review of Thoreau was titled Paradise to be Regained, and it flat out dismissed Etzler's vision for a communitarian future as substantially flawed by its underlining utilitarianism and its dependence on material progress, because Etzler was convinced that the paradise he envisioned could only be brought about by the use of technology and utilitarianism in general. Like many reformers and utopian writers of his time, Etzler believed that social change could only be achieved by way of a collective effort of many people, and he therefore proposed a form of suburban communal habitat that followed European socialist housing models such as Charles Fourier's so-called phalanstery or phalanstère that you can see here, I think. Thoreau was skeptical of Etzler's communitarian ideals, not only because of its underlying materialism, but also because he believed that real change has to begin at the level of the individual. Though he clearly recognized the social, economic, and political aspects of building and dwelling, he, Thoreau, conceived of both as primarily a challenge for individual Americans rather than for society at large. Every man is the builder of a temple, he writes in Walden, called his body. We are all sculptors and painters, and our material is our own flesh and blood and bones. He was convinced that every building of a home should at once permit and preserve the freedom of the individual. Both his commentary on architecture and his narrative of his own life at Walden Pond turn on the notion of individual responsibility and self-reliance. His emphasis on self-made architecture as an expression of individual identity undeniably echoes contemporary notions of democratic individuality. Yet insofar as Thoreau recognizes that the activity of building and dwelling are inextricably intertwined, his notion of architecture reaches far beyond the contemporary celebration of American houses as truthful representations of the spirit of democracy, as for instance in Downing's The Architecture of Country Houses. The task of defining the American home has been understood by many of Thoreau's contemporaries as a nationalist mission. For Thoreau, on the other hand, to perceive ourselves as spatially related to the world around us was a more comprehensive and a foremost philosophical project. Insofar as it claimed a close connection of building, dwelling, and thinking, it strikingly foreshadowed major ideas of Heidegger's oft-quoted essay, Building, Dwelling, Thinking, published almost a century after Walden. And as you may have noticed, at least those who attended continuously the conferences and talks in this series also serves as the title for our series of talks here at the ANS. I'm now going to very, very briefly rehash some of the major ideas of Heidegger's famous essay, because I believe it's really a very important piece to understand this connection of thinking, dwelling, and building. Originally written in response to the housing crisis in Germany after World War II, Heidegger's 1951 address to a group of professional architects has been influential for architectural theories and urban planning ever since. This is in part because it moves both architecture and dwelling to the center of how we are in the world. What is more, by expanding the meaning of the built environment beyond its immediate practical purposes of accommodating human needs and providing housing, it redefines architecture as a form of dwelling in its own right. I mean, just imagine Heidegger was, when he first outlined his ideas, was talking to and speaking to a group of German engineers and architects in Darmstadt. And this is right after the Second World War. There was a huge housing crisis in Germany because of the, you know, immense destruction that had happened during the war. And instead of, you know, kind of outlining step by step what should be done in order to redeem this enormous crisis, he started off by talking about the importance of building for thinking, and then, of course, for thinking as a form and a very important component part of building and dwelling itself. For Heidegger, the function of building is letting dwell, and that of dwelling is not only a means to express and make manifest our being, but also to preserve the four fundamental conditions of human existence, that is our mortality, our relation to the gods, our rootedness in the earth, and our being in space. All four constitute what Heidegger somewhat opaquely called the fourfold. And only if we have learned to dwell accordingly, that is in harmony with the fourfold, these four important ideas, then are we able to build. That's the major argument of this famous essay. In Heidegger's view, architecture functions as a bridge between human beings and their environment. What connects thinking to building and dwelling is therefore more than merely symbolical. Just think of the various meanings geographical, political, cultural, of an actual bridge. A true bridge, Heidegger writes, and I quote him here, is never first of all a mere bridge, and then afterwards a symbol. And just as little, he goes on to say, the bridge in the first place is exclusively a symbol in the sense that it expresses something that, strictly speaking, does not belong to it. End quote. Since we have long been accustomed to undervalue the nature of things by thinking of them as being merely relative to some symbolic or practical meaning, we are no longer able to acknowledge these things by and through their, as Heidegger says, thingness. And that is, of course, also true of architecture and of architectural constructs. What it means is that the bridge, and by extension, any building erected by an interaction of human ingenuity and the environment, must be seen first and foremost as a presencing or a bringing into existence of the essential unity and conjunction of earth, sky, humans, and divinities. So for Heidegger, this is very important. Any building that we design and conceive of, if it is going to be built, will eventually, and if it is true architecture, will eventually pay homage to this essential unity and conjunction of earth, sky, humans, and divinities. Because architecture urges us to recognize that space, quote, is not an external object nor an inner experience, and that man's relation to locations and through locations to spaces inheres in his dwelling. It is, in a double sense, space-making. Architecture is, in a double sense, space-making. It expresses and lends material form to the fourfold, and simultaneously it creates new spaces by way of the physical extension of the built object. So, in you know, he uses this example of the bridge, and of course you can think of the bridge as just any kind of architectural construct that allows you to cross from point A to point B. But of course, by allowing you to do so, it also creates additional new spaces underneath the bridge, a space that, you know, was probably there, but not in the same form, because it's now shielded from the sky. And, you know, for instance, homeless people may use it, you know, for shelter. So there's a kind of new space that's been created there as well. And it of course, also may link if it spans, two points of a river. It may also link two separate spaces into one continuous space. Thoreau also was aware of the fundamental connection between humans and spaces. Time and again, he emphasized that the perfect house is first and foremost a site of contact between inside and outside, public and private space, upper and lower classes. As he points out in Walden, in his own idea of a perfect house, a door is not a threshold nor a separation between interior and exterior space. Hence, he compares his cabin to the only other house he has ever owned, a tent which he used during his excursions in the summer. Like the airiness and openness of the tent, his cabin strikes him as equally porous, delicate, and fragmented. In fact, it is merely suggestive of a settlement and a house, and thus resembles more, quote, a picture in outlines, end quote, than the finished painting. And I quote him again. I did not need to go outdoors to take the air, he tells us, for the atmosphere within my house has lost none of its freshness. It was not so much within doors as behind a door where I sat even in the rainiest weather. Unquote. To keep his cabin and his abode in a state of transitory, gaseous fluidity, Thoreau left all beams, rafters, and interior walls exposed and unplastered. After all, what is a house but a sedes, he asks, a seat, better a country seat. And though he wants future dwellers in the region to know, quote, that they have been anticipated, unquote, his own architectural footprints would be ephemeral and temporary. When laying out the land in front of his house, he took pains to also let parts of it lie fallow, i.e. idle. For it is important to Thoreau to allow other men, future men, to build anew in this very spot. A man is rich, he says, in proportion to the number of things which he can afford to let alone. This, then, is Thoreau's architectural legacy. It is a powerful plea for a minimally invasive mode of building and dwelling, a form of anti-architecture, if you will, that can afford to let things alone, to not to build, just because one can. Rather than a monument to an individual's ingenuity, Thoreau wanted his cabin to be a place for ongoing contemplation and creation. Instead of celebrating its owner and setting him apart from the environment, its prime design objective is to be as inviting and welcoming to the world outside as possible. Unconditional hospitality, whether with regard to the social or the natural sphere, turns out to be the most important aspect of Thoreau's architectural theory. By the same token, the glaring absence of hospitality from almost all modern social and economic interactions only goes to show how much the latter stand in need of reformation and overhaul. In a rarely noticed article titled The Landlord, Thoreau celebrates the traditional but vanishing country inn as a genuinely welcoming house, one that is always open to the public. Its congenial yet fictive innkeeper is the perfect representative of its architectural layout, even though, as he admits in the opening paragraph, one would be hard-pressed to find such an innkeeper in actuality. Thoreau's description of a country inn at which the casual customer, when behaving with propriety, becomes himself or herself a master and a temporary proprietor extends the architectural metaphor into the realm of individual behavior and social relations. Being in the world for Thoreau always also means to dwell properly, that is, in such a fashion so as to minimize one's own footprint while maximizing one's hospitality towards the other, the world outside. The Christian appeal to love thy neighbor as much as you may love yourself had numbers of philosophers and sociologists ponder the plausibility of such altruistic behavior. Clearly, for Thoreau, the extent to which our lives are guided by hospitality defines our humanity. What is more, architecture, in its traditional understanding, reinforces the modern isolation and alienation. Instead of teaching us how to behave hospitable towards our neighbors and even nature itself in Thoreau, modern buildings have become prison walls, emblems of civilization gone awry. And I'm now moving on to a very brief discussion of Adorno before I end on a more general note. A connection between hospitality and architecture can also be found in the work of the late sociologist and philosopher Theodor W. Adorno. In fact, his often scathing critique of post-war capitalist society and the culture industry appears to be driven by motifs not unlike Thoreau's. Given Adorno's cultural and academic background, this is quite astounding. Thoreau was well-rooted in early 20th century bourgeois culture, and his Jewish heritage, though not by far as pronounced as, say, in Walter Benjamin, made him a very different thinker and critic than Thoreau. The latter had been influenced by Emersonian transcendentalism, and his approach to social issues and contemporary culture was not in the least sociological. I mean, Thoreau's was not in the least sociological. Thoreau was interested in the individual, not as an expression of abstract social forces, but as a thinking and feeling human being who had the power to overcome outside constraints be they political, social, economic, or historical. For Adorno and critical theory, on the other hand, there was little individuals could do to improve their living conditions, especially with regard to the United States, where he had lived and worked between 1938 and 1953. Adorno found mass deception and the manipulation of the individual by way of an orchestrated culture industry to be overwhelming. To be sure, Adorno's relationship with popular culture and the media was in no way unambiguous, but that would be the, but that should be or would be the topic of another talk. Suffice it to say that he too associated American culture, due to the practical challenges of its colonial past, primarily with the fear of doing and building. For Adorno, the American genius is firmly rooted in the realm of everyday life and its social interactions, while its European counterpart, in particular German so-called Geisteskultur, is busy preserving the intellectual history and ideas of the past. As he quips in his 1956 radio speech, Culture and Kultur, where he discusses the differences between American understandings and theories of culture and European theories of culture. And there is an online version of this freely available. The sound doesn't work here, otherwise I would have played for you a few minutes of Adorno discussing this idea, even though it is in the original German. I think you've heard that in a lecture in Germany. But it's very interesting that he is very critical, actually, of the German understanding of Kultur, which he calls smug and arrogant, actually, and that he seems to favor American popular culture, even over, you know, the French idea of civilisation or civilization and German Geisteskultur. So he says, you know, Germans are generally tatenarm, disinclined to act, dafür aber gedankenreich, that is, you know, they are great thinkers, but they don't think in terms of ever realizing their projects or ever putting them to test in any form. That is, they are prone to useless pondering and overthinking eventually. America's inclination for action rather than ideas is aptly captured by its skylines and skyscrapers. Not surprisingly, therefore, the oft-quoted section in the Dialectic of Enlightenment, the culture industry, Enlightenment as mass deception, begins with a somber description of the modern cityscape. Skyscrapers, the huge gleaming towers of the modern city, are everywhere. For Adorno and Horkheimer, they are the architectural manifestations of international finance and the entrepreneurial system. Their homogenizing power effectively erases any social or cultural differentiation. And thus, I quote, "The older houses just outside the concrete city centers now look like slums, and the new bungalows on the outskirts are at one with the flimsy structures of world fairs in their praise of technical progress and their built-in demand to be discarded after a short while like empty food cans." End of quote. Even if the modern housing projects appear to be designed solely to, I quote again, perpetuate the individual as a supposedly independent unit in a small hygienic dwelling that makes him all the more subservient to his adversary, the absolute power of capitalism, end quote, modern architecture, such as the bleak quintessence of Adorno's and Horkheimer's critique, reflects as well as reinforces the alienation of the individual. What is more, insofar as it, modern architecture inhibits forms of dwelling conducive to critical independent thinking, architecture turns into a tool to eternally reproduce subservient citizens and consumers. It becomes one with, you know, the capitalist intent to curb and limit the freedom of the individual in modern society. By the same token, in his later collection and of aphorisms, Minima Moralia, published in 1951, Adorno repeatedly invokes a housing crisis, or to be more precise, a crisis of dwelling. One can no longer dwell any longer, he writes in aphorism number 18. Houses are now designed as a tabula rasa. They betray every cognition and make living unbearable. And I quote just from this very brief, obviously, aphorism where he talks about and discusses modern forms of dwelling. Whoever flees into genuine but purchased historical housing embalms themselves alive. Those who try to evade the responsibility for the dwelling by moving into a hotel or into a furnished apartment, as many rock musicians seem to do, make a canny norm, as it were, out of the compulsory conditions of emigration. Things are worst of all, as always, for those who have no choice at all. They live, if not exactly in slums, then in bungalows, which tomorrow may already be thatched huts, trailers, autos, or camps, resting places under the open sky. The house is gone, he states. The house is gone. And for those of you who are interested in how Americans, contemporary Americans, actually often live, just read or watch the adaptation of the novel Nomadland, and you will find that millions and millions of Americans now have chosen, either on their own choice or because they had been compelled to do so, to live in vans or trailers and to move around. And Amazon actually has set up trailer parks specifically for millions of Americans who then at times need to work at least temporarily in order to afford this kind of mobile life. The phrasing here in Adorno's Minima Moralia is almost identical with the description of the modern cityscape at the outset of the culture industry section. Houses, and with them our dwelling, have become discardable like empty food cans. They are obstructions every inch of the way to a more conscious and responsible form of life. Or, in Adorno's own words, they slap the longing for an independent existence, which anyway no longer exists, in the face. Because modern ethics stipulates that one should not even be at home in one's own house, the individual is doomed to be locked into a vicious ideological double bind. With no way out and nowhere to go, there is simply no right life in the wrong one. And thus this famous adage of this famous section in the Dialectics of the Enlightenment. Yet the most striking overlap with Thoreau's earlier critique of the absence of hospitality in both architecture and social relations occurs in part two of Minima Moralia, in a section called Kalte Herberge, Cold Hostel, in the English translation. In his typically scathing register, Adorno here dismisses flat out any so-called progress with respect to modern hotel and culinary culture. Today, he claims, both guests, and I quote him, guests and innkeeper are under a spell. The former are in a constant hurry. They would even prefer to keep their hats on, while the latter has become but a salaried employee. The decline of Hotelkraft, Hotelwesen in German, probably already began in ancient times when the dissociation of hotel, restaurant, and brothel set in. A social and architectural alignment for which Adorno expresses a kind of nostalgic adoration. This was a space of innuendo and illusion in which, quote, smartly dressed waitresses and the telltale gestures of the maids were enticing and conducive to having social intercourse. Today, however, he writes, the staggering division of labor and the system of automated performances ensures that no one is really interested in the comfort of the customer. No one musters the social skills anymore to read a customer's face for what they might be in the mood for, because the waiter doesn't know the dishes anymore, and even if one suggested something oneself, one would be reproved for overstepping one's competence. What remains is merely a concern for the institution at large, which, quote, takes precedence over the subject which is administered as an object. Now, Adorno is talking here about the modern customer in any type of modern restaurant you can think of, and it's gotten even worse. I mean, this has been written more than 50 years ago. If you think of today's, form of Gastkultur or Hotelwesen, hospitality, postmodern or post-postmodern hospitality, if you want, it's all about, monetizing the time that you spend at a restaurant. I listened to a program on NPR about a restaurant in Boston who charged for a reservation that could not be filled because the guy eventually, instead of being able to go to this restaurant and take out his friends, and he was traveling from New York to Boston, you know, specifically in order to visit this restaurant and had dinner there. But he got sick and had to be taken to an emergency room on his way to Boston. And even though he was quite obviously and there was proof that he was sick, you know, the restaurant charged him $250 per person for the reservation. Now you can see this is, you know, how it works, and they expect you to even include in the fee that they often charge you for the reservation, a considerable fee for the tip, which is called in English, as you may know, gratuity. But there's nothing gratuitous anymore about the tip. It's just become part of your bill eventually. And so, you know, Adorno already uses this, the early traces, so to speak, of this development in order to criticize the alienation that's been going on in the larger society at large. And of course, you can make an argument for the small owner of a small restaurant that this is the only way people can survive, these days. But as a matter of fact, it is an antithetical, if you want, to anything that hospitality of old stood for. Now, this section of the Minima Moralia ends on a pithy, ironic description of the synthetic female hostess, which is also an invention of the 1950s. But of course, you may have had similar experiences today or when you were traveling in the United States, the smiling waitress. This modern version of the innkeeper of old, Adorno writes, and I quote him, takes care of nothing and has no wherewithal to bring together the divided and frozen institutions, but is limited by them to a facetious welcoming of the guest and the oversight of her employees. Peevishly pretty, he dismisses her, the waitress, as a usually upright, thin, strenuously youthful and faded woman. Completely ignorant of the needs and wants of the entering stranger, her true purpose, he writes, i.e. to ensure the owner's profit by rationing the time ultimately spent at the restaurant, appears to be the very antithesis of hospitality. Adorno's Kalte Herberge clearly is a far cry from Thoreau's The Landlord, where strangers are invited to make themselves at home and become their own, at least for the time being, master of the house. What's striking, however, is that both writers, their intellectual and historic differences notwithstanding, emphasize the connection of social relations to the built environment. For both, a decline of hospitality in the former is being reflected in the inhuman, repellent facades of contemporary architecture. While for Thoreau, the exploitative building practices of 19th century America marked the beginning of a fatal takeover of capitalist principles, for Adorno, the modern cityscape all but betrayed the underlying facetiousness and negativity of the Enlightenment at large. For both, however, the question of how we build and how we dwell in our buildings became an important driving force for social and philosophical inquiry. And I conclude with this line of thought here. Thank you for your attention.